What's new in Final Cut Pro X? Import, view, edit, and deliver closed captions. Group import file.
Welcome to the Colin and Samir podcast. This week's guest is legally blind filmmaker, James Rath.
That was the sound of James Rath's MacBook reading out what's on his screen. James uses Apple's accessibility features to help him pursue his passion of filmmaking despite his visual impairment. We first met James through a cold email he sent us. We ended up getting coffee and making a video together, which is on our channel right now, and we'd recommend you check that out to get some backstory for this podcast. James is one of the most inspiring creators we've come across. He creates awesome content for his YouTube channel, he directs commercials for big brands, he consults on accessibility features for tech and gaming companies, and he's even had coffee with Apple CEO Tim Cook, which is an awesome story that we get to on this podcast. We talk to James about how he uses technology to adapt to his visual impairment. We also talk about self-acceptance and overcoming mental health issues. It's an amazing experience. Every time I get to sit down with James, I'm always incredibly inspired. I'm very excited for all of you to hear our interview with James Rath. All right, we are sitting here in downtown Los Angeles in the office space, I guess, of James Rath.
I guess.
Yeah. So
yeah, no, it's like a bedroom and an office together. And now a puppy kennel. Den area.
Yes. So James and I just got a cup of coffee, talked about content, life. We met here in downtown LA, and Colin and I actually made a piece with James that was awesome, where we got to hear his story and see some of his perspective on life. James is a legally blind YouTuber, filmmaker, film director, writer, all the above, and a very talented at that. So James, tell us a little bit about that. About how you started. Let's get some backstory on James Rath.
Yeah. So I fell into filmmaking, mainly the camera, when I was 8, and I just found a love for looking through the viewfinder and being able to just like see things that normally you wouldn't. And legal blindness means that there is still some remaining vision, but it's non-correctable. You can't just put on a pair of glasses or get a surgery and you know, boom, you can see 20/20. So when you have a large magnifier that's able to display something that's so far out of reach right up to your eye and you're nearsighted like that, it was mind-blowing for an 8-year-old. I saw details. I'm like, wait, can everyone see this? And then, you know, you can zoom in further and see things that even 20/20 can't see. And I was always sort of a creative storytelling kid. So when I realized I could do that in my backyard with a camera, and like it was accessible to me, I you know, I'd make little movies, little superhero movies with friends in the neighborhood, and as terrible and as cringy as it probably would be looking back at it, it was a sort of a nice, I think it's like the star that most aspiring filmmakers at that age like usually go through. And then YouTube was sort of a thing, like right around that time. I was about 9 when I signed up for my YouTube channel, so my channel is like as old as 2006.
Wow.
So it's 12 years old now. And that's just sort of wild to me to think about that. Like, I've had my channel since I was 9 or 10, and just haven't, you know, obviously used to put some high school films up on there, and like a lot of that's sort of private now, and it's more of like the current brand and what I set out to share the message and everything. But it was definitely a platform for me to experiment with, and YouTube and how accessible online video and sharing is these days instead of like the old process. I mean, I did start editing on a VCR, and then eventually found Windows Movie Maker, and then could barely kind of see what I was doing, but got a Mac, Zoom, and iMovie, and Final Cut eventually, and it kind of like, it all sort of came together within my years. I think I grew up at the best time you could be filmmaking, especially with a visual impairment. So,
I want to dive into more of, you know, how this works, how you are a filmmaker and you know, with your visual impairment. But I think first I want to explain to the audience like your visual impairment and what that means, and just educate us a little bit on what your visual impairment is.
Yeah, I made a video too called like What I Can and Can't See, kind of like narrating through a daily sort of walk or routine in downtown LA, and kind of showing like, what is it exactly that I am seeing and what I'm not, and like emulating my vision for the audience. And what you'll come to find is I see vertigo, which is kind of unique in a sense to, I think, most people who are kind of sighted, or you may experience vertigo every once in a while, but I've been experiencing that since I was born. So everything is constantly shaking and in movement, and like if I don't really pay attention for a few moments, like it just looks like an earthquake's happening, and I'm like, oh yeah, right, nystagmus. And that's what that's called. Nystagmus is involuntary eye movement that just doesn't stop. And for me, it's horizontal. And then I also have ocular albinism, which is sort of the root of the ocular conditions I have. And that's a lack of pigment in the retina and the skin and hair. And so technically albino, I have a little bit more pigment than you'd expect from other types of albinism, but mainly because mine's affecting the eyes. So one cool little thing that has triggered for my eyes, my girlfriend always just checks my eyes every few days, and because they change colors throughout the week.
Oh wow.
So one moment they're blue, then they're green, and then they're gray. So they're constantly like, it's kind of just a neat little thing. If you know me, feel free to stare into my eyes for a moment and just tell me what color they are today. But yeah, so that's sort of just a rundown of how I see. I mean, albinism, for those who don't know, it affects how much light you can intake in the eyes, and it just makes things blurry in general a little bit. So having the blurriness, then the vertigo, and then light overexposing your vision, that's basically what makes up my my legal blindness.
And you didn't grow up here in Los Angeles. You grew up in Delaware, correct?
Delaware, yeah. So a little old state. Might be the only person you know from Delaware.
Maybe. I'm not sure. Yeah, I've driven through Delaware on the East Coast, just through like New Jersey and Philadelphia.
Be sure to stop if you ever need to buy something. Stop somewhere and it's tax-free.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. You're right. I like that.
Best place to go to buy Apple products or something that's expensive.
So I want to hear a little bit about growing up in Delaware. You said, you know, you got into filmmaking pretty early. So growing up with a visual impairment, you know, when was the first time, I guess, you became aware of it? And what's your first memory of being aware of your visual impairment?
So, I mean, my earliest memory, I didn't maybe understand why at the time, but like in kindergarten, I'd have a lady come in, and like kindergarten's when they start kind of prepping paperwork, schoolwork a little bit. You'd spend like 15 minutes beside just playing and music time and whatnot to actually sit down at a desk and like do a coloring book or something, you know? And we had a lady come into the private school I went to who would introduce me to these big magnifying glasses. Some were like dome shaped. I'm sure people who are visually impaired know all about this. And like some would just be like a magnifier that has a light on it and help me just focus on what it is I need to see and read. And like those, it's like a temporary solution, but it, for them, it wanted to be like a long-term like fix, which kind of stinks. So like growing up, I really couldn't read well, couldn't read at all, but I loved writing. And I it wasn't that I like was dumb with English and with like literature, but it was just that reading isn't a skill I can do visually. Looking back now, it's like, I really wish I was introduced to Braille. And they thought maybe I was too sighted to really consider Braille, because like I think that's a misconception. It's like blindness is like an on and off switch. But I mean, if you're legally blind and you're trying to read, it's kind of like, yeah, I can pick up some words, maybe like read for a paragraph, but it causes fatigue. It causes like strain in the eyes. And so I really started noticing it around first grade. And because I did so bad in first grade, like grading wise, they decided like, you know what, we can't accommodate you anymore. So they told my parents like, you can't continue at the school. So my parents made the decision to go to Pennsylvania, 5 minutes from the border of Delaware, and just try the public schools there, which they've heard good things about. And again, it was much of the same, like try to temporarily fix your condition. But I got more one-on-one time with the visual specialists every week, and they'd have someone from the state come in to work on orientation mobility. But it's, again, it never came, well, they showed me technology too, like the Mac and stuff and the Zoom and text-to-speech features, and like that stuff was cool. And a lot of kids who are blind now are growing up with voiceover and text-to-speech rather than Braille. But Braille is still something I do wish I had a skill at, and something I do want to take up as an adult now, and just looking at the best route and best like schedule to do that for the remainder of this year. But yeah, I'd say it's around the first year of grade school when I really, oh, I'm different, and I need to learn differently. But you know, they're doing the best they can. So, but it wasn't until I think other kids really acknowledged that I was different until like sixth grade. And I actually sort of talked about this recently in a video, because this sort of stemmed a whole like mental health spiral, mm-hmm. For me. And I did a video call at the time I went blind again. And long story short, bullying sort of made me want to look into an experimental surgery, and change my eyes. And I could see temporarily for a couple years, like, better than ever. But eventually, spoiler, it went back to how I see now and saw before. So
you had just talked about some bullying in high school. How did you deal with that? You know, or I guess middle school, sixth grade. Like,
yeah.
How did you deal with being different and having other people, you know, react to that? Like, what were the challenges, and how did you overcome them, or did you overcome them? What was that like?
Yeah, I didn't take the best route the first time around. I just sort of, it was new to me. I mean, like, I had always had friends, always, you know, would try sports, but wasn't very good. But at least I could bond over just like the curiosity of sports with the kids who were considered, I guess, more popular. And, but it wasn't even like the popular kids who like would try to poke fun. It was sort of this, it was a big school, and it was sort of another sort of segregated group of kids who were a little bit more ignorant. I don't know how to best, like, without being offensive.
Sure.
Describing them. But basically, they were just sort of, they decided, you know, you're different. I'm insecure about myself or my home life. I'm gonna take it out on you. And I didn't really know how to tackle that at first. And it's just like, these were sort of like threats I was getting at first. And it was like, it all hit pretty hard. And it went on for a little, like, few weeks. And it got to the point where I didn't want to live anymore. So, not to get too dark here, but me at 11 years old tried to commit suicide. Hmm. And so I was hospitalized after, my dad found me and, survived. And so from there, my parents were sort of devastated. They didn't know like what to do. They didn't know sort of how to tackle this. And I just told them, like, I don't want to be like this. I want to see. And so they looked into an experimental surgery, and there was one that we tried. So I went blind for a month while like my eyes were healing. I got to stay home though, so I missed another month of school. You know, it was either being hospitalized or the surgery. So in 2008 we got that, and oh gosh, that was a decade ago. That just hit me. Like, how long it's been. But yeah, I could see better. It was sort of progressive. So it's like my vision is typically 20/300, and then it went like down to 20/150, then down to 20, and down means sort of up in terms mm-hmm. of like, so basically it got to the point where I was 20/90, 20/80. And so I was still visually impaired, but like I could see the board, the chalkboard from like the middle of the classroom, something I'd never been able to see before, even from the front row. And so I never really recovered from the bullying. I could see better. I played sports for those 3 years of middle school, and this kid who bullied me, never saw him once throughout the entire 2 years of middle school. I don't know how, but ended up in a class with him freshman year of high school. And in science class, he decided to back up a little bit. I lost my sight beginning of ninth grade. Mm. So the sight from the surgery reverted back to legal blindness. I'm like, great. How am I going to, I had to figure out how to be more self-accepting of myself. And when I encountered this kid again later in the year, he decided, oh, you know, he never seen me when I was like more sighted. He never saw me when my eyes like completely slowed down with the movement, and it was unnoticeable. So he decides to just bully me again. The kid didn't change from sixth grade. And I'm like, here's an opportunity for me to be a grown up here at 14 and just be like, look, I don't know what's going on in your life, but get over yourself. You know, I have a thing that makes me different, and I'm going to do something with it. And sort of fast forward, I mean, I dealt with sort of recovering from that mental health that was like on the huge decline since that incident. But it really started to get better when I started to accept myself and to realize that I'm here for a greater purpose than, you know, maybe this kid, or maybe there is a purpose, but he's ignoring it. And
yeah.
And I think we all have a purpose. I think you just got to find it and not ignore it. And otherwise, I think you're wasting your time a little bit if you're spending time tackling others.
I really appreciate you sharing that story.
No problem.
That was a very powerful story. And I'm fascinated now to talk about, you know, some of the, I'm drawing so many parallels in my mind about, you know, why take to filmmaking and why take to YouTube when you have an experience like that. Hmm. And when, you know, you're essentially signing up for more eyes on you, more people to, maybe come at you.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly you went through a very, very intense experience when you were younger. And, you know, today you share your life online. You share your life in multiple different formats, and you share your perspective, which I think is a amazing and beautiful thing that we get to do in 2018. But take me up to speed then from ninth grade. You seem to have overcome some of that and become more self-accepting, more empowered. And decided that you want to do something, you know, with the fact that you're different. How did filmmaking come into play?
So in senior year, I was definitely dealing with the baggage a little bit still of having poor mental health, and would have episodes every once in a while of like just anxiety and then some depressional episodes. But I really came to terms with who I am come 12th grade. And I realized I wanted to choose happiness. I wanted to choose my passion and pursue that. And I decided to, I was like debating, do I go to film school? Do I go, you know, school's never really worked out for me really well. Mm-hmm. I always just sort of just made it to not get like held back into to sort of, so essentially, basically I decided to book a ticket to LA. One-way ticket for the summer. And
when was this? After senior year?
2014.
Okay.
So after senior year. And so I came out here. I had some friends already through YouTube to like crash.
Already creating at this point?
I mean, yeah, I was still making videos on YouTube.
When did you start making videos on YouTube?
Videos on YouTube. I mean, when I was 9, I technically was just throwing stuff up there that I just liked a little. But I didn't really find my message until 2014, 2015. I want to say I really found the message in 2014 from this experience of coming to LA. All I knew is I wanted to create. I just didn't know about what. And people started asking me, like, why are your eyes shaking when I'm vlogging and stuff, or when I'm talking to the camera? And I sort of opened up a little bit about legal blindness and how that's affected me. And people became more curious and interested. And people found that video and like, oh, hey, I want to tell you my story, you know. And they share their visual impairment stories and like, wow. Cool, there's a bigger community for this, and there's really no other blind YouTubers, very few. Definitely a lot more today, which is great. And I think the encouragement from people like me, myself, Molly Burke, mm-hmm. Tommy Edison, when he was creating videos, really sort of helped to jumpstart other people to feel comfortable in front of a camera and talk about their experiences. And it created a community. And we've also broken out and crossed other disabled communities to hear other people's voices. So 2014 was really that time when I started shifting to, what do I want my message? What do I want people to take away from my videos? So from my experience being out here in LA, meeting new friends, new experience, like that summer was a summer of experiences for me, learning how to live by myself. This was 3 days after graduating, right? And I just couldn't bear spending the summer trapped in the suburbs, where the nearest bus station to me was 4 mile walk. And I'm like, I need something better. So my parents were scared to death, like let their blind kid just go across the country. And I figured it out a little bit. I mean, I ran out of money, of course, like that mm-hmm. summer. So I went back home, got a job. I worked until the point where I could come back out here. And just,
right.
Here I am now. But yeah, it really came together then, and where I really started to flourish, like my creativity, my message. So the timeline of 2015, creating videos about, hey, I'm blind and here's this experience. And I came back to LA. I started really opening up about the technology I use, and I made a video called How Apple Saved My Life. And that was sort of the story of like when I was going through that really terrible mental health period of my life. And I still like was visually impaired at the time, got a Mac and suddenly could start creating videos again. So that's sort of going, sort of tying the visual impairment, like dark time of my life. Sorry, I totally hit the camera there. So that's tying the visual impairment, dark time of my life with filmmaking and using that as sort of like my coping hobby and passion. So Max really enabled me to help edit videos and continuously upload videos with the accessibility features. So today, I mean, very much doing what I was doing a couple of years ago, but now much higher quality, I think, much better consistency and messaging and connecting with others more.
So there's a couple things that I've learned from spending time with you. One thing that I'm really happy to learn every time that, you know, we spend time together is just the variety and the spectrum of visual impairments. You know, for me, I never knew about that. You know, for me, it was, okay, if I heard someone was blind or visually impaired, I had a certain thought in my mind of what that meant and an assumption. But you've really taught me that like there's a spectrum to that, which I think is really interesting. And then you've also taught me so much about technology today and the accessibility features. And you just talked about getting a Mac and how that, you know, changed and saved your life. Yeah. And I want to dive into that, but I want to backtrack about the logistics of being 9 years old, being visually impaired, the technology that was out back then. How were you filming? How were you editing? How, you know, there's so much that in my mind has to do with sight when it comes to filmmaking,
right?
Like detailed sight, and how were you achieving, you know, filmmaking at a young age when the technology was so much different than it is today?
Yeah. So at the time it was just sort of one of those VCR, little tapes that you'd put into the camera, and then you could take that VCR tape out, put it into the VCR, VHS. Sorry. Mm-hmm. It's been a long time since we've had those.
Yeah.
Wow.
I actually just went, I'm going to go right after this. I'm going to go pick them up. I just dropped off 16 of my VHS tapes at a place that converts them and puts them on a hard drive. So I'm really excited to tell stories about, you know, making some of my first videos. Yeah. This is amazing. So, okay. So tell me, so you used VHS tapes into a VCR.
And I'd middle of recording like a little movie or something or a scene, we'd be like, all right, that was a bad take, let's rewind over that, and then we'd hit record on where we rewinded and it would record over that, and that's how we sort of would make a little movie. And I made something called like Bird Boy. It was about like this kid in the neighborhood who like was fighting, and I was like playing the evil guy, and we just set the camera on a tripod, and like I don't even know the context, but all we had was like a parrot, like a stuffed animal parrot, and I dubbed the voice over for that. There's like a record audio over feature in the camera, and then like there's also another feature where you could put titles, and this is before I hopped on Windows Movie Maker, and you could basically pick up a title from, you could write it down on a piece of paper, right? You just have a white surface, and then you hit like a freeze frame button, and it'd grab that little title over the video, and then you could just like, so I could record you right there and have a text like that picked up from a white piece of paper from the previous shot. Kind of wild. Like, you really had to think out of the box when you were doing like home video recording back then. And to go from there to like Windows Movie Maker, my dad had like a home computer, and I'd figure out how to import video from a newer camera I bought that used these like mini DV tapes, like really tiny tapes that fit like in the palm of your hand, but it was still tape. It was still this concept of taping over bad footage or recording, and like these things could record much more longer format, but then you could plug via USB the camera, and you'd basically, the way you would import the tape into Windows Movie Maker was set it up like a webcam and just hit playback on the actual camera, and you just wait an hour and it would import all that footage because it's just playing the tape and taking that off your camera's display. So that's the first time I dabbled into Windows Movie Maker, and you know, I'd actually be able to slice it, and like, this is like next level. But it was also super hard to see. Like, I'd actually take one of those dome magnifiers from school, and I'd put it up like as if it was a magnifier on the actual Windows machine, on the display, and that's how I would kind of see it. My face was like 2 inches from the screen, so it was a struggle. I'd spend like a week just editing something really small that I could do in like 20 minutes now. And yeah, that was sort of the struggle before I got the Mac.
Did you have any fear going into filmmaking? Like, were there any thoughts of like, this is not something that I'm going to be able to do? Or were you always just fascinated by telling stories and you were like, I'm going to pick up a camera and just figure it out? Like,
it was very much that. And that sort of plays into like what I decided to do and not go to college and where I am like this past year, like the strides I had made. And we had a family friend, very close guy, like got the point, we call him Uncle Jody and John, who my dad grew up with. And Jody and John both worked out here in Hollywood, and Jody actually did the visual effects for Spider-Man 1-3,
Silver Surfer?
No. The one where the girl's arm got bit off by a shark. He did the visual effects for that. And she surfs. I'm trying to remember.
Blue Crush?
No. But also he did Oz, Great and the Powerful, the more recent. Anything under Sam Raimi in the last like decade he did, basically. The last 2 decades. He worked under him a lot, and Sam always brought... Anyway, so we had people who knew what the industry was like, and it was a good support system growing up. Cause like when I was 8 or 9, these guys would come from California back to Delaware to like, and he'd draw pictures of Spider-Man with me. And like, he did amazing sketches, and like, he'd make all these monster movies and stuff. And these two brothers who were just out there doing their thing and sort of figured it out. It motivated me to like, who cares? You know, I'm going to figure this out no matter how hard that industry is. Mm-hmm. And a cool experience when I was 10, me and my dad came out here to check out Hollywood, basically be a tourist. And we got to stay at their place. And he took me on movie sets, to sound stages. He took me to like Discovery and got to do like a whole tour of like their whole like spaceship set. And like, it was just wild. It was mind blowing for a 10-year-old like me to really see how all these like wax museums make their figures and mass and stuff. So yeah, that was sort of the support system I had. So I always just sort of had this mentality of like, I'm gonna figure it out, we're gonna do this, whether film school or not, gonna find a way to make this happen.
Very cool. So I'm so impressed and inspired by that, just the willingness. And it's kind of funny to think about the VHS days. Mm-hmm. And how in a sense that was almost easier, right? Like, there's probably actually less hurdles. You know, as you described, like, if you didn't like a take, you just rewound and press record again, right?
I mean, it's even easier now with an iPhone, like, with a smartphone, sure, to just, let's just do a new take. And if you want to edit very much the same way, like, pop it all into iMovie on the go. Like, I don't really use editing on, because we're sort of at this different skill level where we need certain features.
Yeah.
In like Premiere or Final Cut, that just like a mobile editor just doesn't offer,
right,
the content that we're making. But no, it's very much like kids who, there are kids discovering the same thing that we did, but just with an iPad or with an iPod Touch or even an iPhone, because kids get those these days.
So let's fast forward up to you getting the Mac. You're sitting here, actually, you're wearing an Apple hat. Apple is a huge part of your story and your narrative. If you follow James on any of his platforms, you're aware of it. You know, you've made videos that have been seen by people at Apple and even gotten you to speak at Apple and interview Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple. Apple's been a big part of your life. So let's talk about the story of getting your first MacBook and lead us into how Apple has been a part of your life.
Yeah. So, I mean, love them or hate them, they do great things. And, you know, whether you like their machines or not, the software in it is wonderful for those with disabilities, for those who are visually impaired or blind, because they really take the extra effort no matter what the return is. They don't look at the return when it comes to the amount of people or users who are blind using their machine. But they make it so all their in-house software, like Final Cut, like Logic, can be used by blind musicians or filmmakers or editors. Same thing with those with cerebral palsy or with motor skills that aren't as like fine-tuned. And so Apple goes the extra mile. They have an amazing team who I know personally, like at Cupertino, who are making these, like they have blind people coding this software for the blind. Like, sure, there's some sighted people. But there's at least like 4 or 5 blind employees at Apple who I've met. And it's awesome to think about that. Like, you know, they believe it so much that their software and that their hardware enables people who want to be doers, and to the point where they can get jobs there and help make that a reality. So, anyway, going back a little bit, getting this Mac and realizing, wow, I can zoom. I can zoom and edit an iMovie and then eventually Final Cut. Like, it was sort of crazy to me to sort of be able to like create such cool stuff. And this was during the time like DSLRs were sort of taken off for video, and whether they were made for them or not, they just look great. Great depth of field. And so I had like a Canon C2i as like my first major like DSLR camera. And at the time Final Cut 10 was coming out, I had zoom. And so I started just doing more on YouTube during like high school. And you know, it never really took off for sure. Some short films may have gotten a couple thousand views and whatnot. They're terrible. I mean, I look back at them now, I'm like, eh, you know, he was a kid who was like 13, 14 making this, and not bad, actually.
There's so much nostalgia looking back at your work that, you know, you consider quote unquote terrible. I would not go as far as to say that. I haven't seen the work.
Oh, okay.
But
went back there?
I haven't seen it, but all of that is a stepping stone, right? Without that, you don't have the content you're making today.
Right.
But anyhow, the MacBook has now enabled you to create new things.
Yeah, and I mean, even behind me, I have a 27-inch 5K iMac, which was like relatively inexpensive for what I was getting, package deal. It's an all-in-one, like, top-of-the-line machine, and besides the iMac Pro that came out in the past year. But it's amazing because I have a huge display that doesn't lose any pixels or resolution when I zoom in. And so when I'm editing in Final Cut on this guy, it's like, I'd never even think about being blind, being legally blind or visually impaired here. It's just like, it just works, and it works for me. Whereas I have a Dell right here, a Dell computer that I paid like almost $800 for, but I only use it for streaming. And I find the magnifier compared to Apple's Zoom just so far behind with like intuitive like technology and like user friendliness. So
one thing that's really interesting to me is that, you clearly like, the Mac has enabled you to learn a skill set now and pursue your passion and really pursue a career in filmmaking, where a lot of people think school is that, right? School can offer an opportunity to allow you to pursue a passion or pursue a career, but you made the decision to not go to school. Do you feel like this, like school system or just schools are not really set up for, I guess, people who require support from an accessibility perspective? Or like talk to me a little bit more about the decision of not going to school.
Sure. There's many factors that went into this. I was so ready to just like, I almost went to Chapman University. Biola was my second choice and still in the Orange County area. And there's like Full Sail as well. Like maybe I want to go to Florida. I know my family wants to go there. And I mean, there's film schools sure in Florida that aren't for profit, but it's just something I thought about because I had a cool like program, it seemed like. But anyway, Chapman was like my first choice, but then I realized I only really edited in Avid at the time, and like you learn Premiere at some point, but they don't have Macs in their school system, and so that turned me off a little bit. And maybe we could have fought that a little bit, and like sure, I could learn Premiere or Avid and use my own Mac, and I'm sure for accommodation wise that could have been possible. But it came down to, like, honestly, the school system just didn't work for me. It didn't do much for me, and I barely graduated. I mean, even in my About video, it's like, I mentioned I have a 1.8 GPA, and it's just like, it's not that I'm dumb. It's just that the school system just didn't work for someone like me who was taught to be sighted in a pair of eyes that are not, you know, and aren't meant to be test takers that are timed. And to read constantly. Like, it's kind of wild. Like, I don't know what college experience is like. I don't know how accommodating it is for those with visual impairments. I mean, I know a guy who has the same condition as me, who worked at YouTube and worked at Google. A good friend of mine now, and he runs, like, the entire American Nystagmus Network. But he went to Harvard. And, like, again, it works differently for everyone, I think. He might also have a different degree of vision as well. But it works for some. It doesn't work for some. Mm. You know, it's one of those things where, like, creative people, I feel like, sometimes have an unconventional route career-wise, and also just in general. And there's no I don't believe in the traditional creative route, because my journey was super unconventional, even for creativity, and it might be because of my situation, but the opportunities I have going today, like, I just shot a commercial for a huge brand and directed that, like, and that sort of just kind of came to me with the right steps, but super unconventional. I mean, there's PAs and second ADs who are working on that who are trying to become directors. And I sort of came onto my lap because it was the right thing. And it aligned with, like, my messaging and, like, what I strive to do. So everyone has a different approach to it.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, I think so much now about, okay, school was not very accommodating for you. Apple as a company turned out to be very accommodating for someone like you. And that led you to create more and to put stuff out on YouTube, and then build a community around yourself and who you are. And again, like you said, it's an unconventional path, as a filmmaker and, as someone to go and just create on their own, put it out. Right. It's becoming more and more common. Last night I saw Eighth Grade from Bo Burnham, who's a YouTuber and very proud to have someone who's started as an online creator, put out a movie like that, which I thought was phenomenal, dealt a lot with acceptance and mental health. But, you know, one thing that the movie talks about is, you know, the girl is a YouTuber in it. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of, you know, interesting parallels with acceptance in that. So I want to kind of bring back that thought where, you know, you're in middle school and sixth grade and, you know, it's not an easy process for you to be accepted, or you definitely face some adversity from a, like, bullying perspective. YouTube is notorious for bullying. YouTube is notorious for people kind of coming at people who are different. Yeah. Why continue on YouTube? And did you ever face something like that on YouTube?
Sure. You get those bad eggs all the time in every once in a while. I mean, I've been very fortunate to not have to deal with a whole lot of, like, crappy comments, but there have been some, and there have been instances where more will come through, depending on, like, whether it's the tech I use, you know, and someone who despises Apple. One of two messages usually pop up on the, like, Save Apple Life video. It's like, oh, Apple's so great, praise them, you know, love it. I hate them, but okay, I'll give them credit this one time, kind of thing. Like, and then they move on and probably go hate on Apple at some other kid's video, and you can be anonymous, so there's just so much, but you really have to look at it like, you grow thick skin, I think, from doing it over time. You really can't let those people get to you, because that's what they want to do, that's the motive. Their day's not going well, maybe their life in general, and they've got nothing else better to do than try to tear someone else down who's, like, trying to get, like, somewhere, you know, trying to find success somewhere or share something, share a perspective. And it's one thing to be critical and have criticism, but then there's just people who are just jerks, and you just kind of gotta shrug it off. Something I do is sometimes is I censor some comments, comments that just have, like, vulgar language, for the most part, to kind of keep it, like, a safer environment, like better for a dialogue. You know, there's people who disagree in my comments sometimes, and that's totally okay and cool. But once it gets to the attacking phase, it's where I censor them and cut them off and maybe, like, flag them from commenting in the future. Because it's like, I encourage dialogue. I encourage, like, opposing views as long as it's handled civilly. And so, yeah, it's really just about growing thick skin. And it's great because YouTube, you can have these direct dialogues with people. So there was one instance where I was creator on the rise on the trending page on YouTube, and I took advantage of that because that brought people, trolls who were lurking the trending page. They're like, you know, just sending all these weird, mean comments or just things that just had nothing to do with anything. And within 24 hours, I took advantage of that and I made a blind guy reads mean comments video. And just giving my snarky remarks to these people who are just kind of like in a sad state of mind right now. And to hopefully like find a light in their own lives maybe and just realize like how ridiculous they're kind of being. And I just hope at the end of the day, like combating those sort of comments, they sort of take a moment to step back and just be like, yeah, you know, I should probably figure out a purpose in life or something to pursue, something to do. Because being a troll on the internet just isn't.
Sure. Yeah.
Isn't, I don't think, worth your time.
I just find it, you know, I think it's really interesting. I talk to a lot of YouTube creators about it. You know, like you're signing up to put yourself out there, right? Which means if you have a point of view or a perspective, most likely there's a group of people who's not going to agree with that point of view or perspective, right? Or be angry by it or whatever. So like just knowing that you're signing up for that is an important piece of becoming an online creator.
Yeah.
Being aware that not everyone's going to love your stuff, and that's okay.
Yeah.
I primarily brought up the topic because I love that video that you did of reading mean comments. And I like that you lean into that. I like that you share your perspective because, you know, I was first exposed to visually impaired YouTubers through Molly Burke, through Casey Neistat doing a collaboration with her in a video, and then really started to realize like, wow, the world has opened up a lot to creators. And it's really, really impressive. Again, you said, you directed a commercial, you've moved a lot into traditional media, and we have a lot of conversations around that.
Yeah.
But I want to not go too far away from Apple and from Mac, because you did get to sit down with the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook.
Yeah.
Tell me some of that story. How did Apple end up seeing your content? How did they get involved? And how did you end up setting up a time to sit down with the CEO of Apple to actually talk to him?
So I had actually worked at an Apple store before really this period. And it was the job I worked in between the summers of being in LA and then like saving up money from that job to just come back out here and just figure it out. So from that period on, I don't know. I was kind of hustling, trying to figure out what kind of content do I want to make along the lines of accessibility and technology. But I'm like, what if I just share my accessible technology in like a short film format? And so I did that, and I realized all my accessible tech was just Apple products. So it ended up turning into the video of like, I went back and realized, wow, this thing really did save my life. I don't know what I would have done throughout high school, throughout like battling my mental health, if I didn't have this sort of coping and skill learning set of editing and having that Mac. So I do believe that it was one of those things that really helped me be able to finish my education the best I could. And also pursue my passion and make me really feel like I have purpose, which is filmmaking and activism through storytelling. And so I made a video called How Apple Saved My Life. And then it got sort of picked up by Mac Stories, which is a online Apple-related blog. And eventually it went over to like Apple Insider it went to other Apple-related fan sites and rumor sites. And it was just sort of this feel-good story of, like, here's the impact that companies can have when they really consider other audiences and enable them to do what they love. And it's very motivational, I hope. And I think it has been. So then Apple PR sort of saw the video because it made its way sort of, like, I had Apple retail employees, like, contact me. And at this time, I didn't work at Apple. So they're telling me it's like in the morning meetings that they started sharing this video in many of the stores, and then like just to sort of really start their day with something that like makes them feel good about the work that they're doing and the connections that they're making in the stores, because they don't make commission. They're not there to sort of upsell you. They're sort of there to help you find what's right for you within their product lines. Like, you can be critical of the prices or the design or whatever, but at the end of the day, like, they're just trying to create products that enable you to do stuff that you want to do and break barriers with your passions and connections. So, you know, that's cool. Eventually PR contacted me, wanted to sort of establish a relationship and stuff. And that was great. Cool. They didn't know that I think they were sharing the video internally, like, to the higher-ups, but eventually, like, even the PR lady was sort of, like, blown away that, like, Tim Cook actually took the time to watch it that week, and he shared it on Twitter, which I don't think he's ever shared up at that point, a YouTube video of someone else that wasn't Apple-related, because his Twitter is very... It's either sharing stuff about the company or sharing things morally that he kind of believes in politically, mm-hmm. or fits into, like, him sports as well. He loves basketball and loves Duke, and he's from Alabama, so he's always going to their games. But so it was just sort of one of those out of nowhere things that kind of happen. So that got picked up by CNN. Good Morning America did a interview with me. It was unaired because of Breaking Donald Trump Jr. news the next morning, which was like, I was just like, are you kidding me? Like, of course. This is during the election
time. Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, oh, someone just had to send him a bomb threat at his door. And then some, you know, this poor blind kid can't get his airtime. It was fine. I mean, I recovered from that. And so CNN picked it up, Huffington Post, A+, which is Ashton Kutcher's site, and like other Mac sites eventually would pick it up further. And I just sort of established this connection with Apple. Also at the time, I decided I need a job. I'm living in LA, kind of running out of money a little bit, doing what, you know, I'm doing. At the time, I think I had like 2,000 subscribers on YouTube and eventually grew from that. But got a job in an Apple retail store over here and kind of kept doing that. But also at the same time, I sort of kept this influencer relationship with corporate. So while I'm like working part-time at the store, they invite me to come up and speak, like not as an employee, but like as a influencer to like talk about accessibility and my experience with filmmaking and technology to a group of corporate employees, and hopefully they take away something from it. Basically, I did a similar thing yesterday too at Sony, which is really cool. And so seeing like that sort of public speaking and accessibility consulting sort of flourish from like that was really neat to continue to do that, because it's so much fun, and it's just like I get to help make products better for people like me. And eventually Tim Cook wanted to meet, so we set time aside for the next day and got coffee, and he told me like he loved my videos and stuff, and he's seen more than just the How Apple Saved My Life video. And so we did a sit down interview, and I was like the first YouTuber to do that. There's two other YouTubers with me who were there, like Tatiana Lee, who runs a whole blog about accessibility in Hollywood, and then Ricky Pointer, who's like really a prominent voice in the deaf community on YouTube. And so the three of us sort of got that opportunity, and it was just really cool to sort of just sit down and talk to someone who is passionate about human rights and believes in what the company's doing. This is the same guy who had a shareholders meeting, like stood up when someone asked, like, why are you bothering to make products for the blind when you could be using that time and resources to make your products better for the masses? And he's just like, we don't look at the return. And if you don't believe in making products accessible to everyone, you can get out. And literally said that to someone with like a stern, angry look. And I'm like, that's the kind of person who I would want as a leader. You know, someone who stands up for other people, despite being in the business to make money, like every business is. But to be able to put some of that resources into things that like just make the world a better place, it's cool. So that's sort of the story, a little bit of like how that happened. And it was just like, it just aligned with everything I was doing, and cool experience. So.
What an inspiring story. Like what an amazing result for a video. You know, being creators, we put out a lot of content, you know, like we're constantly telling stories. And what's really interesting is you never know when you tell your story who's going to receive it.
Exactly.
Sometimes it's not about a million people watching it. It's about the one person watching it.
Right.
And the fact that Tim Cook got to see that video, I mean, that's an unforgettable experience that you got to have, and an awesome, inspiring story that every time you put out a piece of content, you just don't know.
Yeah.
You know, if you're telling your story, you don't know who's going to see it and who's going to react to it in a certain way and want to connect over it. I mean, even you and I, and we've connected through us making content and you reaching out and finding out that we were in the same neck of the woods.
Yeah.
So like that's really awesome. So yeah, I'm always fascinated by, you know, sharing a story and having a honestly remarkable response like that. So cool. So I wanted to ask you, you know, now you continue to create YouTube videos. You are also working more on the traditional side. You're directing commercials. You're writing shows. What do you want people to take away from James Rath content? So whether they watch a YouTube video or watch one of your commercials or a movie, you know, what I guess is the message that you want people to walk away with from your content?
Ironically, I want people to open their eyes. No, but like in seriousness, I want them to take the message that like I might see differently. I'm not blind to the world, you know? I might have medically the term legally blind over me, but it's really opened me up to different ways of thinking. I always believe that accessibility is like one of the leading innovations, and like you and I use like a thing that little did you probably know it was an accessibility tool, which was text messaging and email, was made by a deaf couple decades ago.
Really?
To communicate, yeah.
Wow.
And now that's used by the masses. And I think accessibility, I mean, adaptive clothing, for example, when it's stylish and it's being done by big brands, like that's something that maybe disabled people need now. But like, why can't everyone use that? Just making it like save you a minute.
Can you explain adaptive clothing?
Sure. I mean, like, think about a button-up shirt that has like 10 buttons going up. What if you could just snap it in place with magnets? That's a thing that's happening with Tommy Adaptive, with the Tommy Hilfiger brand, with like that stuff has been around for a little while, but not in fashion brands. That's like Calvin Klein, Tommy, Nike, and so it's cool seeing brands sort of take notice to this marginalized kind of group that's like huge too. It's like a billion people on this earth live with a disability of some sort. And that's like 1/7 of the world. And I think 1/5 Americans have a disability. Little do you know, I mean, like someone might be invisible. You might see someone noticeably in a wheelchair or using a crutch like down the street, but you might not realize that so many other people who just aren't showing it have a disability. And it's everywhere. It's not going away. But the great thing is that we live in a world that can embrace accessibility, that can embrace like ramps stairs, you know, because like a ramp you can use with a stroller, you can use more than just a wheelchair, you can use a dolly, things you gotta move. Like it just makes sense to make things accessible because it can be used for many different purposes beyond just letting one person up. Mm-hmm. That was one more than before with stairs, you know. It's just sort of, it's a different way of thinking. So I just want people to sort of take away a way to see differently. I just want people to realize, like, I want them to be entertained. I have a dry sense of humor. I'm like very deadpan in a lot of my videos, but at the end of the day, like I try to walk away from the camera with a serious message for the viewers, and that is to just consider other ways of thinking, consider other ways to experience things, and because very much likely maybe one day you might need to, and so being able to adapt to different ways of doing things, playing sports, playing instruments, using a computer, editing videos. Like, it's not the end of the world. There are other ways to do it if something were to happen, you know? Mm-hmm. So I just want people to be like sort of prepared and mindful, not scared, not fearful, but more motivated to learn and incorporate accessibility into their daily lives, whether they're able-bodied or not, so.
And you've connected with a lot of the, you know, the community, the both visually impaired community, the overarching accessibility community. You've showed us a lot of creators that we weren't aware of before, mm-hmm. and even down to your girlfriend who connected with you through the content that you put out. Correct?
Right. Yeah, and she's got low vision as well, so it's like we just did like a blind Q&A called Legally Blind Couple Q&A, and we just talk about like what it's like to be a visually impaired couple, not being able to drive, considering where we live, considering what we can and can't do, but also just like how do we relate to one another, having someone who gets it and is supportive, versus someone who might be. I've dated sighted people in the past, and like there's pros and cons to any kind of relationship, but it's just interesting. It's been a different experience, and happy to share that with people because I'm sure people are curious, but people also like, you know, or would you be hesitant? Would you be hesitant to date someone who has a visual impairment, and why? And maybe you'll realize like not much different. You can connect over certain things, whether it be that difference or a similar passion, like, why not? So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's an amazing thing that the internet has done, is offered opportunities for people to connect with communities. I mean, there's probably a sixth grader with a similar visual impairment to you who's sitting and watching your content.
I get those comments all the time, and I appreciate every single one. Like, people share their stories, and it's like, it's hard to respond to every single one, especially, like, I upload a video. I'm typically not on YouTube or in that, like, creator studio for, like, another week or so, checking those comments. I do read them all. Sorry, I had my computer read them all to me, and it's great getting those, and I appreciate every single one, and hope that other people can also have that dialogue in the comments and connect with one another, respond to each other's comments, and I mean, that's the thing, community building. It's so cool, because it's like, I might not be able to respond to little Timmy in sixth grade, but Donna, who's maybe like 20 and can share her experience with little Timmy, can, hypothetically.
Sure.
But it's cool.
Yeah, I think community building around shared interests or, you know, shared experiences is really powerful. And I love YouTube for that. I think it's such an amazing platform where, you know, whereas when we were younger, we didn't have too many opportunities to connect online with people who we could see that had similar experiences as us, or even we could just follow along with their journey and be like, that's aspirational for me. You know, again, there's probably someone watching you who's like, wow, I didn't even know I could be a filmmaker, right? And I'm watching James Rath, and I now want to become a filmmaker because I know it's possible.
Yeah.
That's really powerful.
It's I encourage it. You know, it's like, it's all there. It's all accessible at this point to do. There's going to be maybe a few things that roadblocks, but figure it out. I mean, filmmaking is all about thinking outside the box. It's all about using what you've got to make the best story you possibly can. And I think accessibility very much falls under that, you know, adapting and trying to figure out. And like, when you bring the two together, it's just like, even, it's just such a cool paralleled experience, I think, that people don't think intersects. It does.
So today you tell stories for a living. You share your perspective for a living. You shared a lot of amazing stories on this podcast. I want to ask you, you know, just for anyone who's listening to this podcast or anyone who consumes your content, who might be dealing with adversity, might be dealing with acceptance. What advice would you give to someone who's might be going through something similar that you went through when you were growing up?
It's really about, I think you got to find your passions and what you love to do. And if you can't find an exact passion, find the impact you want to leave, and figure out how you can incorporate that into your life. Like, how can you impact people, whether it's just in your community, it's just in your group of people who are like you, or on a global scale. How can you make that happen? For me, I mean, globally, I want people to acknowledge disability on all parts of the world. And I'm trying to figure out ways that I can do that. Luckily, the internet really lets me connect with people to bring awareness to, like, how their cultures and societies intersect disability or completely ignore it. I feel like these are conversations we need to have, dialogues that should be shared, but also, like, what can we do to help? What can we do to maybe another country is just better than us, you know, in a sense, with how they treat people with disabilities. So I really think it's about finding your purpose, finding what that impact you want to, like, what's your philosophy? Someone asked me in my comments, like, or said in my comments, I love your philosophy. And I never thought of, like, I'm not a philosopher.
Right.
Like, but I guess at the end of the day, I do have a message for every one of my videos. And I thought about it. I'm like, I guess there is a philosophy with James Rath, with the YouTube channel, and not every video might align with that per se, but like, there's typically a message at the end, in the overall channel and the overall, like, content I put out into the world and the impact connections I want to share. And it's about just motivating people and spreading awareness that accessibility drives innovation and drives a society forward. So
you know, you have a lot of exciting things coming up. We just talked about some of them over a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
A lot of films and shows you're working on. What can you share with us in terms of upcoming projects, things we can expect for James Rath in the future, and even some goals of yours of where you're headed?
So the free content will always kind of be there, not stopping to upload to YouTube, and really, like you and I talked, and I'm just going to say it now so I can check myself on it by the time this podcast is out, but Facebook, I'm going to take a deep dive into Facebook and make sure, because the content I make, I feel like is very much, it gets shared on Facebook, but I've just been neglecting that platform for so long, and I really feel like I could make a bigger impact and more people could be educated throughout Facebook. And so there's a commercial coming out around October that I directed, and got to work with some incredible people. Like the guy, he's got a movie coming out. His name is Matthias, and he did a Pooh Bear. Sorry, the live action Christopher Robin.
Christopher Robin.
Yeah. So he was my DP on my latest commercial, and can't really quite say everything about like what it is and all that, but it's pretty awesome. And like if you go see that movie, just know that this commercial is gonna look incredible. I hope, because I can't really see it, but I'm just making a joke here. But no, it was a great balance. He's amazing with light. You'll see it in his cinematography, and light is overexposing for me. So like finding that good balance in a collaborative medium, I think is important for other blind filmmakers or other visually impaired people who want to make visual medium art. Find people who can kind of like build up your weak spots visually, and you'll come out with something incredible with like your overall creative vision versus their technical movement. Like it's so cool. And I'm sure there's like, I've done cinematography before. I don't consider myself the best with that, and that's why I like directing, I like producing, I like hosting in a sense. But yeah, just find collaborators who see eye to eye, no pun intended, and yeah, just really find good collaborators. They're out there.
All right, so James, where can people check out your content, your storytelling, your perspective? Where can we follow James Rath?
James Rath is basically the name on everything, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and that's spelled, drop the W, J-A-M-E-S-R-A-T-H. And yeah, you can find me tweeting away. You can find me Instagramming at some point every once in a while, and YouTube uploads pretty weekly, I think. Bi-weekly, depending on schedule. And then Facebook. Go like that
coming
Facebook
soon.
Page. Yes, there's going to be a lot more content coming to Facebook.
Amazing. And if you want to see the piece that Colin and I made with James, you can see that on our channel. We'll put a link to all those things, James's content, our content with James, in the description of this podcast. But James, thanks so much for sharing your stories. Yeah. This has been amazing.
Thank you.
We're just shook hands.
Right,
yeah.
Now. Yep. For those who can't see.
You can't see
all
this.
All of you who can't
see. We just shook hands. Yeah. All right.
Cool.
That's it for the podcast.
All right. Thanks, guys. Bye.
That's it this week for the Colin and Samir podcast. We hope you enjoyed our conversation with filmmaker James Rath. Colin will be back next week, and we have some really exciting guests lined up for the month of August. On this podcast, we talked to James about self-acceptance and mental health. And for anyone listening who is struggling with mental health, we want you to know that you're not alone. And we've put links to resources in the description of our podcast.